Welcome to Division 3 of the Colorado Court of Appeals. We are convened this afternoon to hear two arguments. The first is in 2009 CA 74, People versus Chacon Posada. And the second is in 2009 CA 1621, In Re, the Marriage of Tosignat, is that close? Okay, are attorneys for both cases here? Both sides of both cases?
Yes, sir, we are.
Okay, not in the second case?
Not in the second case.
Okay. Let me make a brief record. The arguments have been set for 15 minutes per side. There is a timing mechanism for keeping track of that time. It's digital. There is a module on the lectern, which will have a green light for the first 10 minutes of the argument, a yellow light for the next 5 minutes, and a red light when the argument is over. There's also a countdown digital clock that'll allow either one of you to keep track of how much time you have. I would just tell you that this morning that the modules failed. The timer didn't, but the modules did. And it's for a highly technical, sophisticated reason. They became unplugged from the electrical. We don't expect that to happen today, this afternoon, but should it, the bailiff will be keeping track of the time. It doesn't prevent him from keeping track of the time, and he will give me a high sign when you have 5 minutes left, and I'll relay it because he's behind you. And he'll give you me a high sign when you have 1 minute left, and I will tell you again that you have 1 minute. If you want to reserve time for rebuttal, you may do so. You may keep track of it if the modules work, and I have every reason to believe they will. You can keep track of that on the countdown module if you want me to give you a high sign or some indication that you've reached the time that you wish to reserve. You need to tell me how much time you want to reserve, and I'll use my best efforts to do that for you. As I've indicated, the arguments are limited in time. We have read the briefs. We have read some of the authorities cited in the briefs. One of us has been into the record to some considerable extent. So you may assume safely that we understand the law basically as cited in the briefs and the facts as put forth in the briefs, and we would recommend that you go directly to your legal issues rather than dwell on the facts. But the time is yours, and you may use it as you wish. The lectern has a microphone on it. The microphone has two purposes. One, to amplify the argument in the room, and the second, to record the argument. The arguments are digitally recorded. They will be placed on the internet, on the court's website, within 1 or 2 business days of the argument. Because of that, we would ask, both of those reasons, we would ask you to stay at the lectern or very near to it so that we can get a clear recording of your argument. Next, the lectern is adjustable with toggle switches. It'll be on your right, one to move it up and one to move it down. If you find it uncomfortably high or low, please take a second or two and adjust it to your comfort. And last, but by no means least, if anyone in the room has a cell phone, an iPhone, a pager, I guess they don't make pagers anymore, but a pager or other things that may go off unexpectedly, please turn it off. So that if it go, it won't go off and disturb either the panel or counsel in the course of what those of you who are visiting, I think, will come to view as a conversation. It is called an argument, but it is in fact a conversation between counsel and the bench about the issues, and so there'll be conversation going both directions. And it's important that everybody be able to hear clearly and not be disturbed. All that said, does anyone have any questions about how we're going to proceed? Okay, then we are ready to hear People versus Chacon Posada.
May it please the court, I'm Andrew Cooper for the People. Admitting the deposition testimony at trial would not have violated due process or the Sixth Amendment right to confront. If anything, it would have violated the Sixth Amendment right to effective assistance of counsel. Regarding due process, the defense had actual notice of these hearings on a Thursday for hearings that were to occur the following Tuesday. The district court did not give an extensive due process analysis, but they found that that was not reasonable notice. The people maintained that that is reasonable notice under both the rule and the due process clause. We believe that what the defense should have done, given that they only received discovery on Monday, the day before the depositions, it is if they felt that they were not prepared for the depositions, they should have appeared rather than refusing to appear.
Counsel, what's the trial court's determination that it didn't, that there wasn't sufficient time or notice?
Is
it discretionary?
Well, I think it's a de novo review because it's expressed as a constitutional finding of a due process violation. And I think the court here can and should find that that is adequate notice for the purpose of due process.
Mr. Cooper, I have a question about the reasonable notice aspect. I understand that the judge who actually heard the trial found that there had not been reasonable notice. And what I'm wondering about is when the other judge who initially set the deposition, the defense counsel filed this notice of non-appearance, which I think could be construed as an objection that there was not reasonable notice. And did the first judge make any sort of finding about whether the amount of time had been reasonable? And if so, how was that finding done?
Actually, three judges involved. The first judge who set the deposition was Judge Fisher. The judge who conducted the depositions was Judge Sylvester. And then the trial judge, Judge Tillman. Judge Sylvester at the deposition received the objection that day. It was filed that day. And he did make findings as to when notice was given to the public defender's office. I don't recall whether he inquired about the receipt of discovery, although I think that actually that information I think was in the objection itself. And but Judge Sylvester did find that their failure to appear acted as a waiver of the right to confront. That I think he found that there was reasonable notice.
What is the geography? I mean, I realize we're out on the Eastern Plains, but and the district attorney's office is in Arapahoe County. Are these counsel out there? Is the public defenders out there? Can they respond to a one-day notice or a two-day notice for deposition, or do they come from Greeley or Fort Morgan or wherever?
I'm not certain where that public defender's office is. I think that it's out in that area. I can't be certain.
Would that make a difference? I mean, the last I knew, and I don't know exactly what counties, because I know this is the 18th district, right?
Yes.
Okay. The office in Greeley, public defender's office in Greeley, covered a lot of eastern and northeastern Colorado, and I would assume they had to come from Greeley, but I don't know.
Well,
would that be germane to whether it was reasonable or not?
No, because they had actual notice on the Thursday, which provided them plenty of time for them to arrive on Tuesday if they chose to arrive. Instead,
are we to assume they had nothing else to do?
No, I think that if their objection had been, I have other things scheduled for that day, they would have said that in their objection. Instead, they filed a blanket objection stating, we're not going to do this. This is inadequate notice to us. And on the issue of actual notice, it should be noted that this notice didn't just receive the attention of the local public defender who is assigned to handle matters in that courtroom. It reached the attention of the very highest level of the public defender's office, because the objection that was filed on the day of the depositions was signed by the statewide public defender, Douglas Wilson. So it had the attention of that office. They had actual notice. Regarding, then, the issue of confrontation, the people maintain that the defense waived the opportunity to confront by choosing not to appear. The defense can do that. It can be a matter of trial strategy. And the trial judge here noted a couple of times in making his record that this may have been strategy on their part. And I would submit that if this lower court's rulings stand, it was very effective trial strategy because they effectively engineered the inadmissibility of these depositions by refusing to appear and refusing to participate.
What role did the defendant's participation or attempted participation at the hearing have with regard to your confrontation argument? My understanding is the defendant was present and asked if he could confront and cross-examine the witnesses, and it was denied.
That's correct. I think that Judge Sylvester, who presided over the depositions, was correct in that because the defendant was represented, he could not ask those questions on his own.
But how did he waive the confrontation right when he asked for the right to confront and cross-examine the witnesses?
I think the case law is that the decision of whether to cross-examination belongs to counsel rather than to the defendant. The defendant, unlike some other rights, does not need to personally make that waiver.
Mr. Cooper, I understand that there was some discussion that it would have been preferable for the defense attorney to ask for a continuance in order to have time to prepare for cross-examination rather than just not to show up. And I understand that we're looking at this in hindsight and not as the events were developing, but when it became apparent that certain of the witnesses were there longer than anticipated, was there any effort to redo the deposition so that the defense could have an opportunity to cross-examine after becoming more familiar with the case?
No, there wasn't, and I would maintain that that counts against the defense rather than the prosecution. The court set these deposition dates. The defense did not request a continuance. The depositions were held. If the defense wanted to conduct a cross-examination, they could have done so. I think what they should have done was to have appeared on the deposition date and either, if they felt unprepared even to do direct examination, sought a continuance of that. And if not, they could have conducted observed the direct examination and asked for a continuance as to the cross-examination. Now, it's possible that as time passed, some of the deponents would have been deported. If that was the case, cross-examination could have occurred as to those who remained. And then the trial judge, in assessing the admissibility of the depositions, potentially could have decided, well, I'm going to allow the depositions where there was cross-examination, but not allow the others.
One suggests that procedure to the trial court?
No, I don't think so.
So it was just the defense didn't show up, oh, well, they waived it, so let's proceed?
I think the when you read the transcript made by Judge Sylvester at the depositions, he clearly was a bit befuddled about what to do. He used the term whipsawed, said he was being whipsawed by the non-appearance, but under the circumstances, I think there was nothing inappropriate with him going forward, and having completed those those depositions, I think that they should have been admissible at trial. We cited a number of cases, Hewitt from Washington, Furlow from the Ninth Circuit, and Rice from Georgia, which had somewhat similar circumstances in that there were short notice depositions with limited amount of time to prepare. And those courts held that those deposition testimonies were admissible at trial. Regarding the Rice case, I would say that we don't need to, here in Colorado, follow every aspect of the Rice decision, because in Rice, it happens that there was direct examination, a continuance was granted for the cross-examination, and the deponent died before the cross-examination would occur. Georgia said, well, the defense had their opportunity to cross-examine on the first day, and because they didn't do that, they waived the opportunity to confront. I don't know that Colorado needs to reach that question here, because all I'm suggesting is the defense should have shown up. If they needed a continuance to do the cross-examination, they could have requested that and conducted that. And then at the time of trial, as to those where cross-examination occurred, perhaps the trial court would have at least admitted those.
Center piece of your argument that the defense waived cross-examination?
Yes.
Now, the defendant is there without counsel, did not appear, and defendant asserted his right, and you're saying only counsel can waive the right to cross-examination, and my concern is counsel wasn't there. Now, you're saying that the defendant has to stand defenseless because his counsel is not there.
If we lose this appeal, it's very important how we lose. It may be that we should lose on the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel. The Sixth Amendment contains a number of clauses. One is confrontation, another is the right to counsel. If these depositions were not admissible at trial, I would submit that it was because the defendant was denied effective assistance of counsel when his counsel failed to appear. That's an important difference.
It's a difficult argument to make, isn't it, in light of the facts? Because, in fact, because counsel didn't show up, the depositions were not admissible and all the charges were dismissed. So how is the failure of counsel to appear ineffective?
Well, and actually, charges were not dismissed. They were submitted to the jury. The jury found not guilty on the felony charges.
Some were dismissed and others went to trial.
Well, I think your question goes back to something I said earlier, which is this may be very effective trial strategy. If these rulings are affirmed and it's determined that the defense, in effect, can engineer the inadmissibility of these depositions by not showing up, then it may be this will be happening.
It seems to me it's a potentially reckless tactic, if that's indeed what they want to do. But why was this all done on 3 or 4 days' notice? It's not clear to me that all of these people were going to be gone in fewer than 10 to 12 or 14 days, and indeed many of them weren't.
Well, Rule 15 speaks of a 48-hour requirement if a person is taken into custody for the purpose of the depositions. Unclear whether that applies to this situation where they're in federal custody. I would think that if the state had taken them into custody and before turning them over to the feds would have asked for the depositions, then that 48-hour requirement would clearly apply. But another requirement is Article 2, Section 17 of the Colorado Constitution, which requires that a person not be held in custody longer than may be necessary to take his deposition. So these individuals, although they're in the country illegally, have civil rights also and cannot be held. They certainly could not be held to the time of trial without any charges against them.
No, I understand that. That length of time would be probably out of line. But many of them didn't leave for several months.
That's true, and I would submit that is a reason that the defense could have attended and conducted cross-examination at a later time.
Counsel, on this issue of the waiver of the right to confront, would the defendant have waived the confrontation argument, cross-examination argument, if he had participated in the depositions, even though he wasn't prepared?
If the defense attorneys had?
Yeah.
If they had participated in the...
If they had shown up and they had participated in these depositions, would they not have then waived their confrontation argument and their cross-examination argument? But even though they didn't think they were prepared, if they had showed up, to those depositions?
No, because I think they could have asked for a continuance. They could have at least asked for a continuance as to the cross-examination component. I think that would have preserved that right.
So the linchpin of your argument then is their failure to ask for a continuance?
Yes. Defense counsel should not be allowed to engineer the admissibility by simply refusing to show up. And I'm out of time, but I would also ask that the court reflect on the second component of confrontation, the unavailability issue, as briefed in the written briefs. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Andrea Gamel. I'm appearing this afternoon on behalf of Mr. Chacon Posada. Your Honors, it strikes me that this is a case where the prosecution is upset that it lost its case and it's looking for someone to blame. I would submit, however, that the person to blame for this is the state itself. Some of the facts that the court was asking about, first off, actual notice to the public defender's office that depositions of 10 Spanish-speaking witnesses was not provided to the public defender's office on the 29th. What happened on the 29th, which was a Thursday, was the public defender's office at 5 p.m. received a fax from the court with a notice of appointment, public defender's application, and a little handwritten note at the bottom of the page, which said, Rule 15 hearing, December 4th at 10 a.m. I think the public defender reasonably understood this to be a setting of a future date of some sort of depositions in the matter. Certainly a reasonable attorney would not expect that would mean, oh, depositions have been scheduled without any input from me, particularly since Rule 15 requires reasonable notice to the parties.
Well, counsel, let me just jump to the very end of your counterpart's argument. He took the position that the linchpin of their argument is the defendant's failure to ask for a continuance in this case. Do you agree with that? And why didn't you ask for a continuance?
For a lot of reasons, I think the state's own positions belie their argument that that would have been effective. One, the judge, Sylvester, actually said that he would not be amenable to granting a continuance because it was a hardship on the court. Second, the state's position is that these depositions had to occur so quickly because the witnesses were going to be deported immediately and they had no control over it. And second, there's a case cited in the state's brief which says if you ask for a continuance to prepare, you then waive the right to cross-examination. I think what happened in this case is rather than the public defender being crafty and trying to engineer some sort of great trial result, was that the public defender was put in an untenable position that 4:37 on the night before the depositions were scheduled to occur was when the prosecution was when the public defender's office first received the notice that the prosecution was intending to depose 10 Spanish-speaking witnesses the following morning at 10 a.m. That same day, the day before the depositions had already been scheduled with no input from the public defender previously, was when the public defender first received discovery on the case and received a DVD of witness interviews of all of these witnesses conducted in Spanish. It's completely unreasonable to think that the public defender could have been prepared in any way to appear and conduct any sort of meaningful cross-examination at that point.
Rather than just making the unilateral decision not to show up, the defense attorney couldn't go to court and point out that the Rule 15 requires reasonable notice and that hadn't been given and that the deposition should be reset for however many days would be reasonable?
Well, I think that that was effectively what the notice of we're not appearing was an objection to setting this without any input from us.
Certainly,
and I think,
excuse me, if no attorney appears, though, how can the court determine what's a reasonable time if they just don't show up? I mean, I think the trial court should have an opportunity to question counsel and explore the position and figure out what might be a reasonable time if a reasonable time hadn't been given under Rule 15.
Well, I think that the facts as they were laid out to the court were clear that that wasn't reasonable notice.
Do you agree with Mr. Cooper that the Judge Sylvester made a finding that it was reasonable, or do you disagree with that?
You know, when you asked that question, I quickly looked in my transcript, and I just quickly reviewed the beginning before they started talking about other issues related to the depositions, and I didn't see any finding with respect to whether that was reasonable or not. He made some findings that the public defender chose not to appear, and that sort of thing, but there was no discussion that I saw, at least, about the reasonableness of the notice that was given.
Is there a public defender resident in Lincoln County?
There is not. It's my understanding, and we have occasionally shift which regional office covers the outlying jurisdictions, but I believe at this time that it was our Douglas County office that covered Hugo and Lincoln County. So the Castle Rock then would be where the office is actually physically located, where the attorneys are who practice both in Douglas County and have responsibilities for covering docket out in and cases.
The DA's office is similarly limited. I mean, they also have multiple counties they cover and may or may not have a resident DA in Lincoln County.
I don't know that for sure. I think that most district attorney offices, even in the smaller jurisdictions, have an office within each jurisdiction, but I can't say that for sure.
Let me ask you this, because I heard you to say that you didn't have a chance to find in your record whether there was a finding by the first judge or
mm-hmm.
not. Is that right?
That's right.
If we go back and we discover that the first judge made a finding of reasonable notice, was the second judge bound by that finding?
I don't believe so, because the issue that's on appeal, really, which is part of the arguments that we have in the brief, is what is the issue on appeal? The issue on appeal is not what the public defender should or should not have done. The issue on appeal is whether the trial court exercised its discretion properly in excluding this evidence from trial. And that's a discretionary decision. It's subject to abusive discretion review, which was your question earlier. And I don't see that there would be any reason why the second judge would be bound by the first judge's order, particularly given that counsel was not present. There wasn't a record made at that point by defense counsel as to when we actually received notice, what we had or had not been able to do in the case. The record about, you know, not meeting the client and having not been able to do any investigation into the case or anything that needs to be done before a constitutionally adequate cross-examination can be conducted, that was a record that was made later at the second hearing, where we moved to exclude the evidence.
Of course, it wasn't made at the first hearing because counsel wasn't there.
Right.
So how could a record have been made if counsel voluntarily elected not to make it?
Well, I think the problem is this. The public defender was put in this position of having two very difficult choices to make. One, not appear. And this is certainly a decision the public defender's office does not take lightly. And it's highlighted by the fact that the motion, the notice that we would not appear was actually filed by Doug Wilson, not by the regional public defender. This was a matter that was taken with a lot of seriousness because obviously we take a representation of our clients extremely seriously. Second, and now I lost my train of thought.
You had two choices.
Oh, the other choice. The other choice was to appear and do as the prosecution suggests, which is to conduct this sort of half-assed cross-examination of these witnesses, and to then later be put in the position where surely the state would have argued, well, you had your adequate opportunity to confront. So I think it was really a no-win situation for the public defender's office at that point. They chose one of two courses of action, and it ended up as it did, and the state is now appealing the exclusion of that evidence.
Changing the subject slightly, are you taking the position that the defendant has to personally waive the right to confrontation, or is that a decision that can be made by counsel?
Well, I think the law is clear that, assuming counsel's present, I think that's a problem. Assuming counsel's present, the decision to cross-examine a particular witness is a decision that counsel gets to make. When the defendant is personally present in the courtroom and asked to confront the witnesses and is denied that opportunity by the court, it is a personal right of the defendant. Under the Constitution, clearly, it is a personal right of the defendant to be confronted by his accusers and to be able to ask questions of them. So when counsel is not present due to no fault of his own, it cannot be deemed a waiver of his right to confront when he has no, when he has nothing to do with the fact that counsel is not present and has made affirmative steps on his own to secure that right.
Depositions, I haven't seen them, but my guess is they'd be pretty straightforward. Are you a legal resident of the United States? Yes or no? When and where did you enter and how? Isn't that about all they would ask?
Well, that's all the prosecution asked, right? I mean, I think as a defense attorney, I would certainly have a lot more questions that I would want to ask. However, for example, are any of these people actually possibly co-defendants in the case? What's their motive and bias for testifying in this case? Do they have prior felony convictions? Any number of things that bear on credibility, bias, what was their role, and facts of the case. You know, it requires, did they actually pay Mr. Chacon Posada? Had they never seen him before? Was he only filling in for 5 minutes and driving that stretch? Anything that might create reasonable doubt in the case would be something that, as a defense attorney, I would want to ask about, and I would only know if I had had opportunity to potentially interview the witnesses myself, conduct some investigation into the case, interview my client. I mean, there are many things that you need to know before you can conduct a cross-examination that would pass, you know, a constitutional adequacy test. Another thing I would say with respect to the waiver is that the trial court specifically found that Mr. Chacon Posada had not waived the right to confront the witnesses, and part of that ruling was based on the fact that he had attempted to cross-examine the witnesses himself and had been denied by the court. But also the court found that even if the public defender had appeared, that the cross-examination conducted, given the short notice, would not have been constitutionally sufficient. So the court's order is effectively that you couldn't have waived a right which could not have been effectively exercised in the first instance.
Let me just change the hypothetical following that line of argument. Let's say that there wasn't 1 day notice, but there was actually a week or 10 days of notice, and the public defender felt like they hadn't actually had time to prepare even with that amount of time, so they just decided not to show up. Would that constitute a waiver?
It's hard to say because it would really depend on, I mean, you're applying the same exact facts, these same witnesses, the same number of witnesses.
Sure, let's just say that okay. There was more notice, 7 to 10 days. I'm trying to see where the line is. Let's say there's 20 days of notice.
Right, well, I mean, I think
that's not show up without being a waiver.
It is hard to draw the line. I agree with you. It is hard to draw the line because the rule requires reasonable notice. The interpretation of what's reasonable is necessarily fact specific. So if in this case the public defender had 7 or 10 days notice, and in that time had been able to, you know, meet the client and interview some of these witnesses, conduct some investigation, then a non-appearance, then if those were the facts, might be a lot more problematic. I'm not willing to say that actually would have been a waiver, but I think it would have been a lot harder argument to make that you mightn't have waived by not showing up. But that's not the facts that we have. The facts that we have is that, you know, less than 24 hours before depositions of 10 witnesses were scheduled to begin, the public defender first learns that this is going to occur. And having been put in this really awkward position, the public defender took one of the two, you know, bad choices that it had to make and chose not to appear, and left Mr. Chacon Posada in the position where he tried to effectuate his constitutional rights himself and was denied. I think that applying the appropriate standard of review here, which again is not a de novo standard, we're not, you know, arguing that there was some sort of a constitutional violation that actually occurred in the case. The court prevented a constitutional violation from happening by excluding the evidence. I understand the state's upset with the decision to exclude the evidence, but the ruling is not arbitrary, you know, unreasonable or unfair, and it rests on factual findings which are well supported by the record and therefore must be affirmed by this court on appeal. And I guess Oh, sorry, Judge. Did you have a question?
No.
Okay, I just wanted to say, touch on the unavailability factor that the court meant that the prosecution asked you to address. I don't believe that that's a matter this court needs to address for the resolution of the issue, because unavailability is only an issue if there already is a constitutionally sufficient cross-examination, which would be admitted into evidence. Clearly, that didn't happen in this case. So unavailability does not need to be decided to resolve the appeal.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Thank both counsel for their arguments and briefs. The case will be deemed submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. The next matter on the docket is In Re Marriage of